Good afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio. It is January 25th, 2026, and I'm still Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Still Bill.
Still Bill.
A.K.A.
Willis.
Willis. So we're talking about our friend and our boss and our representative, Congressman Doug LaMalfa, the day after his memorial down in Chico. And so we have a group of staff here. Couple of our guys from D.C. So we have George.
Hello.
George's nickname was?
Jungle and Junkie George, depending on Chief's mood.
Depending on whether he's in trouble or not.
Yes.
And we have?
Sam the Sham, parentheses, and the Pharaohs.
Because you didn't know who they were.
I didn't know who they were, but he knew I liked sort of older music. And so that was how I got that name.
I remember when you were like, who's Sam the Sham?
And I was like, what's this guy talking about?
How old am I, right? And we have Brenda Haynes.
Bun Bun.
A.K.A. Bun Bun. And we have Laura Burnett.
Landslide Laura.
The Landslide Laura. Won her election by 3 votes. Which made the landslide part just even funnier.
Yeah.
Doug just had a funny idea, you know.
Yeah.
I was Dan Newhouse. He always called him Lieutenant Dan.
Lieutenant Dan.
I can't tell you how many times I was in the car, and he'd be like, hey, it's Newhouse. And he'd be like, Lieutenant Dan! He's the accent. You know, when he'd answer. Who were some of the other ones?
Oh.
Hawaii.
Oh, the Hawaii lay. Takuda. Her name was Barracuda.
Barracuda. Mr. Potato Head.
Her name was Fedorchak.
Yes, Fedorchak was Woodchuck.
And no, but he would say, how much wood does a Fedorchak chuck if
yes.
a Fedorchak would chuck wood?
Yeah.
She's like, I'll never hear that again.
Yeah, and the gal in the tunnel we were talking about earlier, she had a nickname. Everybody had a nickname.
She worked at the information desk in the tunnel.
Yes, in the tunnel. She had a nickname. I don't know her nickname, but all the floor staff had a nickname. And sometimes it was a rhyme, sometimes it was something real.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, everybody he came in contact with had a nickname. And for us in the DC office, you would have to call people by their nicknames. So, you know, you'd be like, Congressman Newhouse wants to, and he'd be like, who? And you'd go, Congressman Newhouse, and you'd go, who's that? And then you'd get the what he was doing, and you'd be like, Lieutenant Dan wants to write a letter. And it was disarming, because, you know, D.C., there's lots of people that are sort of buttoned up and very serious.
And full of themselves.
Full of themselves.
Yes.
And you can't be full of yourselves when a sitting congressman is telling you...
Lieutenant Dan!
Lieutenant Dan! and showing you David Bowie music videos. Like, that's...
Right.
You can't do that. So...
Yeah, oh, and Fong, Vince Fong. He was the Fongressman.
Yeah, Fongressman.
Fongressman.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There were like a million of them.
Yeah.
But they were funny. Like, a lot of times when people get, like, a nickname, it's an inside joke. This was just, like, kind of a term of endearment, and it was an outside term of endearment.
Yeah.
Like, everyone. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lobbyist I did a lot of work with. She was in and out of the office. We were trying to secure the rural schools. She had really sort of like bright red hair, and she just became the redhead. That was her. He'd be like, hey, is the redhead with you? My wife was the old lady because she's younger than me and about 5'2". And he thought that was really funny.
So she was the old lady.
The old lady. How's your old lady? And then she would come in and visit, and he'd be like, ah. It's the old lady. So, you know, it's my tiny little 5'2 wife. He didn't change the names.
No.
Yeah.
It wasn't transitory, liked you, didn't like you kind of stuff. There was somebody who was named EP.
Yes.
That I will not out. But it was pretty funny. Like, sometimes it was initials, sometimes it was, a descriptor, but it just kind of made things more fun, actually.
Yep.
Kevin McCarthy. So back when we were having the whole drama with the Speaker of the House stuff, and people really did not, they were mad at Doug for supporting Kevin McCarthy. Remember that whole thing? How could we ever forget? Ew. And Matt Gaetz, the pig, is now gone. Yay. Just for the record, I always knew he was bad. I used to tell Doug, he's horrible. And Doug's like, no, he's nice, because Doug was way nicer than all of us, which we spent 2.5 hours talking about yesterday in public, right? Doug was always nicer than we were. And I said, no, he's horrible. And he's like, why do you say that? And I'm like, well, because you know what? I think ultimately he's going to screw us. And I think he's a bad guy. So something would happen, and you know, 6 months goes by. We'd be on the phone. Doug's like, so, you still hate Matt Gaetz? And I'm like, oh, yeah, all day, every day, twice on Sunday. And so this was like a running joke, right? Hey, how's Matt Gaetz? I'm like, nope, still not on the team, not on the team. And then Matt Gaetz flips his good friend of many, many years, Kevin McCarthy, out of his seat. And I'd like to tell you I'm a bigger person than this, but I'm so not. And the first time we spoke after that, I'm like, so, how about Matt Gaetz? Are we ready to revisit that yet? And he's like, yeah, you were right. You were right. And I'm like, you should listen to me more. So we have some clips of Kevin McCarthy because his commentary was really quite good. And I thought, just in the quick stuff I could do this morning, we were able to see a little bit of the inside, you know, back relationship that they had from the assembly days in the state. So how about the car? The car was, oh, wait, you already played the car. I already played the part about the car with the peaches in the parking lot. The Biden one, the State of the Union. A lot of times people saw Doug sitting on the aisle at the State of the Union. And those of us who worked for him know he never got anywhere early, ever. Did he ever get anywhere early in D.C.? Yeah, no, okay. No. It was the same here and there, bi-coastal lateness. But he would arrive hours and hours and hours before a major thing like that, State of the Union or something, and sit on the aisle so that he could have a few seconds with whoever the person was, so whether it was the president or Benjamin Netanyahu or somebody who was speaking on the House floor at a special speech. And McCarthy had a little back information for that.
I remember when I was speaker, when the first State of the Union, Joe Biden gave this State of the Union. And when it was over, he didn't want to leave. He wanted to greet everybody. You got to understand, the Republicans all leave. And it was the Democrats sitting there, and like others, they want to take pictures. And I look over and I see Doug. I'm up in the rock. I'm trying to get his eye. Why are you waiting? Yeah. I have to. You don't. You know? You can leave, right? And I've seen people take pictures. Oh, please don't take a picture or a selfie like that. He didn't. You know why he stayed? Because of you. He wanted to talk to the president about the forestry and the fires and the water in his district. He never once pulled his phone out. You know what Joe Biden did? He admired that. It made a difference. And he would sacrifice his own reputation because of you. He was always there for you.
Yep. And so people would ask, like, and then there were times when he would wait for, like, President Trump, and then he, like, he could see them whispering, and my phone would blow. Did you guys have that, too?
Yeah.
All of a sudden, your text messages would explode, and everybody's like, what's he doing? What did he say? What did they do? I'm like, it just happened. I'm watching it on TV, same as you. What do you think? But that was always something to watch for, and I think people really, like that. You know, 535 members of Congress, and like, hey, we know that guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he always, I mean, a big part of what he did was, I mean, pretty much every time it was wildfires and water, and we got to do something for our people. And that's what I heard from him after every State of the Union is what he talked about. But people would come unglued. They'd be like, "What? How dare you talk to Joe Biden?"
Right, right. What was he doing? Yeah. I'm like, oh, he's switching teams. Okay, no, he wasn't. What do you think he was doing?
Yeah. It's always amazing that the people here in our neck of the woods would make a judgment about what they saw on TV. Like, how dare him talk to Biden? Well, I understood that after he did talk to Biden about water and timber, that Biden did send over somebody to talk with him.
Yeah,
the
White House sent people to go talk to us, which, I mean, how it works in D.C. is almost always, if your party is not the president's party, the president is not sending White House legislative people to go talk to you about your problems. That's just, you know, you're locked out. So that was highly irregular.
In true Doug fashion, it worked.
It worked. It worked, and some good things came out of that. And at the very worst case scenario, at least some people had to hear about the problems that we have up here, and they had to sit with that and think about what they were doing to us. And that was the very worst case scenario. Best case scenario is we got some things moved around.
Yeah. And that's why he was there.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people kind of lose sight of sometimes, I think, is he's there speaking for us.
And but they wanted
never missed an opportunity.
Yeah, they wanted him to be like a flame-throwing, right-winger and give fiery speeches and denigrate everybody. And they didn't understand why he didn't do that. But that doesn't actually work. And his way was a lot better.
Yeah, like that way it leads to ad revenue. It does not lead to representing your district super well. And he was no less right than anybody else that they wanted him to be like.
Well, it's kind of funny because Kevin McCarthy talked about that a little bit, and here's a little insight on that.
And he exemplified that. You know, in Washington, we put food in the back to try to get you to come, because members aren't wealthy. Kind of live away, and they're just trying to get the food. And it seemed like every time I'd see Doug in the back at the inn loading up his plate again. Well, Doug, we got to cut back. He said, no, it's not for me. He was going to the cloakroom to feed the staff, because they were staying late too. And he knew them all by name, and they had the nicknames. They called him Chief. But when I said everyone matters, the reputation he had, if there was two people meeting, Doug was there. That's how we knew he would win. And he would take the opportunity to work with the other side. It's a testament to who's here. Because I'll promise you, I don't think some of them are coming to my funeral.
That was the pinnacle of levity at that point. I think that was the most we laughed and I think it caught everybody off guard, actually.
It did.
But it was super true.
Yeah. And when he said it, he sort of panned his face to Gavin Newsom, you know, across that section of the audience.
Oh yeah. And Bill and I were sitting back and about three seats to the right of Jared Huffman, and I immediately looked at him, and he had like a huge kind of smile on his face, like, true story. A confirming smile, we'll call it.
Yeah. And I handled natural resources, energy, and all that stuff for Doug, which, you know, we sparred with Mr. Huffman a lot, and I thought it was really funny, and Doug would have thought it was funny, that I walked into the funeral right next to Jared Huffman, who we had fought against for the whole time I've been in D.C.
Forever. And who he had just his last, I'll find that. But his last time on the floor, they had a battle. I'll find that, and we'll play that a little bit later. But he really felt like Mr. Huffman was going to ultimately, if Prop 50 was upheld, kidnap his constituents. He was not happy about it, and yet Huffman did make the effort to come all the way out. All the way over.
And credit where credit's due. Like, on the floor, when they had an hour for him, for members to talk about him, Mr. Huffman gave one of the better eulogies for him.
Yes, he did.
He's been 20 years back and forth with Doug, and you know, they were arch nemesises, but I think he still understood what a big man Doug was.
Yeah.
Well said.
Yeah, it's interesting how that translates, because from what we've said, you would think, oh, well, Doug was a moderate, right? Because that's the way these things are cast these days. So, yeah, Doug got along with everybody. Everyone liked him. He was a moderate. But Doug was absolutely not a moderate, and his voting record was in the top, what, 3, 5?
Yeah.
Conservative voters in the House?
Yeah.
The whole House?
Well, what did Trump said, we never have to call him.
voted with Trump 100% of the time.
Yeah, and on social policy, he was sort of a heavyweight because he was the first guy to introduce, sort of the flagship bills on gender transition, banning that, and things to protect kids from sort of the excesses of what's going on in California. And it's some guy from California, but it makes sense. You know, it's a guy from California who's listening to people in his district who are having to deal with the things inflicted on them by the state government. So we got it way before everywhere else did, way before this stuff became sort of national conversation. So, he in D.C., people respected that he was sort of the first to the fire on a lot of these things. But, he wasn't going on the news screaming about it, so a lot of people just sort of didn't know that.
Isn't that funny? And so being the press guy, George, mm-hmm. when you were the press guy, how?
Oh, I had fun when it came to the gender stuff. His favorite floor speech while I was there was one that I wrote for him, where I intentionally called that, his real name is William Thomas, but he, on the news, you might know him as Leah Thomas. He's some, 6-foot dude who's
right.
a swimmer who, tries to swim with girls because that's
right.
just what they do over there, I guess. but I made sure to have him, on at least 3 occasions during that 1-minute floor speech, call him out by his name, William Thomas, and Twitter blew up for about 4 hours where all these lefties and all these trannies and whatnot are, oh my god, he's so mean, I can't believe he said that. And Chief comes back afterwards and he's like, huh, think I made him mad? And I said, yes sir, that's what you pay me for.
So you were
oh, and he let me throw fire, I got my flamethrower out.
Yeah, but which George were you? You were Jungle George.
That was a Jungle George.
That was a Jungle George moment.
That was.
Okay, so I found the clip on the wolves. So the preceding part of this, and were you there during this one?
I had the privilege and honor to be there.
Okay, please set it up for us, because what did Huffman say?
So basically, Mr. Huffman and his cabal of associates were
yes.
on the other side, basically saying, they kept referencing Little Red Riding Hood, and how, these wolves are not a big deal, and these are just, ranchers and big business want to kill all the wolves so they can drill for oil, and they don't care about the environment. Yeah, there's this oil narrative that makes
okay.
no sense. Anyway, there's just, you can go and look at it. They're basically saying, oh, your people are
hysterical
over nothing and making
up stories.
This is hysterical nonsense, and it's not real, and you just want to kill the environment and strip all the protections away from every single thing, and, it's a big giveaway to big oil,
That's really, I didn't know that. That's a very
yeah.
weird connection.
There's no oil up there.
Well, they're not sending their best.
All that being said, and then Doug said,
pretty much my colleague from Arkansas. It's amazing here. I represent the northeast corner of California where the wolves are being inflicted upon the people and the wildlife of that area. And the stuff I hear coming from the other side of the aisle about recovering the wolves and even the mocking, yes, it's real. There's wolves that are encroaching on elementary schools in Siskiyou County, the Little Shasta Elementary School. This isn't some Little Red Riding Hood story. This isn't some made-up deal. It's very real. And they're coming closer and closer to town all over the northeast part of California. So my colleague from the North Coast, when he mocks us like that, I'm wondering, if this Proposition 50 in California kicks in, and he ends up representing my constituents up there that are fighting against this, and I'm their only voice in that echo chamber of California against this, are you going to have town halls up there? Are you going to go into Modoc County, Siskiyou County, Sierra Valley, and tell them this is a Red Riding Hood story about the wolves devouring their livestock, eating up all their wildlife? It's the mocking. Why is it you
can't
stand?
The gentleman will suspend. The House will be in order. Gentlemen may continue.
That was Huffman.
Why is it you
out?
Can't stand the people that produce the food, the lumber, that come from my part of the state, from the West, from the rural parts of America? Is it you want all of your beef, if you don't eat beef, you might be able to have this conversation. If you want your beef to be imported from somewhere else, you don't want it not to be produced here under our standards, Why is it you hate my constituents that just try and provide the urban people with what they need? Because we don't need a hell of a lot that's coming from the urban area, I'll tell you what. So if you want to cater only to Marin County and have this population continue to devastate our people up there and rein in just a little bit the misinterpretation of the Endangered Species Act over the 50 years, yeah, it was well-intentioned when it came out. It was a temporary tool, but it never was meant to be a life or even a death sentence for livestock and for people's livelihoods in this area of here or all over the West.
The devil went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sewing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul, because I think I'm better than you."
Good sense, innocence, crippling mankind. Dead kings, many things I can't define. Old Cajun's blood, swaggin's blood to your mind. Innocence and compliments, the color of time.
Who cares what games we choose?
Doug and the Music. Okay, so the youngsters in the room, because Bill and Laura and Brenda and I, we know all the music, but you guys, how foreign was it?
He would always, this. We had to explain this once a week. We have government computers with bad speakers, and he would always be like, pull up this song.
You have what?
We have government computers.
Oh, government. Yeah,
you know, in D.C., and they have really bad speakers because the government's not trying to get you to, like, listen to music on your computer.
There's no stereo.
Yeah, there's no. Yeah. And he would always be like, "Hey, like, pull up this song," or he'd reference something, people wouldn't get it, and then he'd be like, "Well, now we need to show it." He would stop meetings. He would be late to things. He would be late to committee. He would skip out of committee for a second just to, And one of the last things is, it was kind of weird. On my way here, I was like, "What are we gonna think about with Doug? What are we gonna talk about with Doug?" Every week. You know, when he came in, he'd say, "Hey, kids," and then he'd kind of greet everybody. When he would come to my desk, he would sort of lean up against the desk, and he would look at me from sort of like the side, and he'd go, "Hey, man." And as I was driving here, David Bowie's Suffragette City came on, which he made me pull up for somebody once. But the chorus is, "Hey, man." And I thought, but that was he did that for everybody, staff, sometimes we would get mad at him. We'd be like, "Hey, we get it. Your boomer music, it's cool, but we gotta go to a hearing with the secretary right now." And he'd be like, "No, this is important."
Oh my God. Yeah. It's funny how, because we were 10 months apart age-wise, so we listened to all the same songs and, you know, watched all the same movies, and I tend to remember stuff like that and reference things like that a lot. Like, you were kind of trained when you were at our office. How many times did I show you YouTube things?
Generally, the end of the day. See, you were smart enough. You scheduled at the end of the day, usually. You'd be
like,
"Hey,
Sam, you need to. I need to bring your knowledge base up so you can, you know, be current in the Wayback Machine."
Yeah. And, I mean, like you said earlier, I went to Humboldt State, so psychedelic music, sort of some of that 60s stuff carried up. So I was the greatest inoculated against not knowing things. But,
sure.
He really pulled some obscure stuff out.
But then there was the not obscure that would catch the age, and I'll have to put that clip on here. So at one point we went on a field trip up to the dope grows that we have talked about extensively on this program. If you'd like to see photos of them, you could go to the pot tab at wethepeopleradio.us, click on pot, and you can see all the pictures of what we went to see. And so I had finagled it so that we were there that day when they were doing a bunch of demolition on grows they had raided there. And I told one of the guys, I go, "Hey, see if you can get Doug to get, you know, drive one of the bulldozers so we could drive over some of the stuff." And he's like, "Oh, that'd be so cool." I go, "Oh, he'd be super excited." They're like, "Well, does he know how to run a D8? I'm all, "Mm-hmm. Yeah, he does. He's good." So he gets to drive over this greenhouse, and he just was having a field day. So he gets out, he comes out, whips the door open, and he wants to lay down the line. Anyone? Back to me. he does like a big breath in, and he says, "I love the smell of diesel in the afternoon. It smells like freedom." And of course, we're like all laughing and stuff. And that clip got put out in a, I don't know, like a, was it a press release or something? It got put on, you guys actually know?
Something. I mean, it kind of
flew before my time.
It flew everywhere.
So you didn't do it? That was before your time?
I had to hear the story from folks in the D.C. office, and this was like after, I guess, it had sparked lawsuits or something.
It turned into, it became controversial because it went out, and then I had someone who will remain nameless call me and say, "What the heck is wrong with that anyway? Why is everybody so upset about that?" And they said it's Asian hate. And I'm like, well, the people that are growing there are predominantly Asian, which has nothing to do with it. They're basically criminals, so, you know, nobody cares about that. However, might have been the line he used. Well, yeah, but that's a famous line. I go, "Do you know where it comes from?" No. This was the person who put it out, actually. And, and I'm like, that's a really super famous line from Apocalypse Now. She's seen it. The funny part was that was in real life, and it was like the face. No. I'm like, yeah, that's from Apocalypse Now. He goes, "Why didn't someone tell me?" I'm like, because everybody already knows, right? He goes, "No, I know the line, but I didn't know the movie." So every now and then, Doug's obscure references would cause blowback. That was,
yeah,
that went on for a while.
We,
the Apocalypse Now.
Oh. Yeah. It's still going on in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, I mean, we would have to argue with him about, he would use SpongeBob to explain things in committee.
Yes.
He'd be like, "Hey, you know, it'd be like that episode where, like, Squid," you know, he would, yeah, like, sort of play-by-play an episode.
This is just like Patrick Starr.
Yeah, to, like, try to explain a problem. And what's sad is usually he was right. It was a good way to explain. But explaining through via the instrument of SpongeBob in a congressional hearing or in a meeting with a secretary is a little like, oh. And
let's boil it down.
Yeah. you know, but, I mean, it was super awesome to be in it, you know, these big scary meetings, these closed door meetings, and everybody's really serious. And then he would bring up SpongeBob and to look at people's faces.
God, that must have been awesome.
Like, is this really happening? Is this congressman using SpongeBob references? Give me hearings.
He kept them all very humble.
Yes, yes. And Austin Powers, I mean.
Yeah, a lot of Austin Powers.
A lot of Austin Powers. Three Amigos.
Yeah.
Anything Mel Brooks made, really.
Star Trek?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Star Trek?
He got like a time when Kirk told Spock this and this,
yeah,
and this.
He would get in arguments about Star Trek with actually the same gal who had the red hair. He had sort of gone back and forth over whether Next Generation versus the other, you know. And we were trying to get like $500 million of funding for something, and I was like, hey, I don't know that this is what we should be doing right now.
Did it work?
Yeah. We eventually got it. They, you know.
Ultimately, you got the...
Yeah, we eventually got it.
Got the money. So, Speaker Johnson had some comments at the... I was going to say at the beginning. I can't remember. But he talked about how many times Doug spoke on the floor. And during the break, we were just like, oh, we can't forget to mention that. So, cue Speaker Johnson.
You all are in California, this beautiful land with this perfect weather, and we left Washington this morning about 5 a.m., and it was like 12 degrees, and with the wind chill, it was well below zero. At least it felt like that to me, a Louisiana kid. But there's a polar vortex you may be aware of going through the country right now, and about half the country is shut down. Most of our colleagues are grounded. But in spite of that, because it's Doug, I had to arrange to get Air Force Two to bring a plane full of members and staff out here to be a part of this. I mean, there's very few people who could muster that kind of crowd under these conditions, okay? But Doug did. The vice president gave us the plane. I had another one arranged, but we had a mechanical error. So this went all the way to the top, my friends, because it's Doug. Yeah. I want you to know how special Doug was to me, and I'm not the only one. Everybody has a story like this, a testimony like this, of what he did for them or how they felt about him. And I got to know him really well a few years back. I was serving before I became Speaker. I was the Vice Chairman of the House Republican Conference, and the obscure job of that obscure title is that my weekly responsibility was basically to try to recruit members to come onto the House floor and fill the time there so that the Democrats wouldn't capture the time. And so that we could use that well, because the whole idea was we were trying to amplify the message of the House Republican caucus and get it out there for the C-SPAN viewers, you know, all 20 of them that were watching late at night. And then I would try to sell my colleagues every week so earnestly. You know, I was serving under Speaker Kevin McCarthy, and he'd go fill the floor time. I'm trying, Kevin, I'm trying. And I would say, come on, guys, it's great. It's everybody on C-SPAN's watching, and you know, and you can clip the video and put it on social media, you know, and then people will think a lot of folks saw it. And, you know, it'll help us get the message out. I mean, they basically gave me the same reaction that you did. And so I had to fill an hour every week. And so here's the long story short. Very few people participated in this activity, okay? But you know who signed up first every single week? Doug LaMalva. You know why? Because he showed up. And there was this one night that just resonates with me, and I'll never forget it. It was one night, I mean, literally, I had to fill an hour, okay? Doug is the only person who showed up. And it was a night we had canceled session the next morning, and so everybody just jetted to the airports. I had a few RSVPs, but they backed out, they dropped out. Well, Doug showed up. Now, remember, he had to fly all the way back home to California, but he put his name on that paper, and he wasn't going to leave me there by myself. And so Doug and I know. Doug and I stood there and filled an hour, the two of us. And everything he said was deeply meaningful and powerful and resonated. I mean, it's great. He was a great orator. I mean, and we finished, and we were walking off the floor, and I put my arm around his big shoulder, and I said, brother, I love you, but why, you didn't have to do this. Why did you do that? And he got real serious. He gave me a dog, you know? And he got really serious and looked at me, and he said, because I believe in you. And, I'm not going to make you stand here and do this by yourself. And he said, and I believe in this cause. And I believe in what we're doing here. And I believe in this great country. And I think we ought to take every opportunity available to us to stand on that House floor and tell the American people what we're doing for them.
Wow. Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
No. I thought that was pretty telling. Very telling, actually. What do you think, Alex? Got music? He does. All right, we have to take a break. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's getting near dawn. When lights close the tired, I'll soon be with you, my love.
Make a new start. Going to California with an aching in my heart. Someone told me there's a girl out there with love in her eyes and flowers in her hair.
So we're going to just keep listening. We're running out of time. So we've got, I don't know, like 20 minutes left. So we're going to cram in all the other stuff we've done over all the years. But back to the Speaker Johnson clip you heard right before the break. Doug spoke a lot on the floor.
So Doug was often the number one speaker on the floor. He
Number of 1 minute speeches, like
number of time on the floor.
There you go.
Over the course of his whole tenure, he had probably he hovered between 3 and 1 constantly. He won most. They have little competitions to like make sure that everybody wants to be on the floor, and he would always win. There was 1 year we boycotted. Because one guy owned like a newspaper, and he was counting every time his speeches were in the newspaper, and Doug was like, we're not participating in that. But frequently,
poor George, he's like, he's always conspiring to screw you on the press side, wasn't
he? Yeah, that was the thing about doing press for Doug, is he didn't want to do it, and then when he did it, he was extremely particular. And he was like that about, on Capitol Hill, they have the prayer breakfast, and that's a closed door. It's a Bible study. Doug didn't brag about going to that. He didn't really even talk about it, but absolutely nothing could be scheduled.
And it was Thursdays.
Yes.
It wasn't once a year.
No.
This was a regular appointment.
Thursday morning. He went every Thursday. And he had only, as far as I know, I'm not a scheduler, so I'm sure Savannah's scheduler will yell at me if I get this wrong.
No, she told me this.
But she told,
yes.
We could move around kind of anything. You could schedule anything, except nothing could touch the Bible study. And then after the Bible study, he would go to the Bible study, and it was like an hour, and he wouldn't leave early. He would go every Thursday. And then afterwards, he would mark up everything, and he would take doubles, and he would bring one back for him, and then, I have a degree in religion, he knew I was interested in that, and then he would give me his half for me to review. And
of whatever the papers were,
the scripture, their devotional. And then sometimes if he thought something was relevant to somebody in our staff, he would try to give it to them. That was the thing about him. He ultimately, he was all of our boss, but his real concern, especially in D.C., because we're all so much younger than him, was making sure that we got to heaven. After the Charlie Kirk shooting, the assassination, he pulled us all in the back office and he talked to us about a little bit about what happened, but ultimately I think what affected him is one of the only times I ever saw him tear up. And it wasn't about that really, it was about that any of us could go. And he sort of sat us all down, was like, you guys, you need to make sure that you're where you need to be in your faith. And he sort of shared the gospel with all of us. Some of us, or most of us, are already on the team in some form or another. But that's what he was really worried about. He didn't talk about going to church. He didn't talk about going to Bible study. I'm pretty sure he'd be mad about.
Oh yeah, me. that we outed him.
Yeah, I've outed him as a man of God. Because he didn't think that was the point of it, right?
Well, he wasn't shy about it, but he was never going to tell you that.
Yes.
All these people who tell, well, I'm a Christian, and that's like the first thing they say about everything. I never heard him, like. If someone asked him, he would tell them.
Yeah.
But that wasn't his disclaimer of who he was.
Yeah. People would always ask me, they were like, is it like a Catholic or a Protestant? And I'd go, well, I don't really know. He's not getting denominational on it. He's very devout, and he would go to all the Bible studies. But he was always trying to make sure people were caring about what was most important.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's funny, and you think in Washington, D.C., everyone thinks that everybody goes there and changes. That's another point. I guess we didn't really make, but he never changed. And I mean, for my part of it, I cried when he got elected to Congress, because all I could think of was, oh, no, now he's going to become all yucky like those guys. And he never, when I interviewed with him, I told him that, I said, well, I'll do this, but if you ever lie to me, or you ever ask me to lie for you, or I find that you've done something weird or creepy or wrong, I'm going to quit that day, and I'm going to get on the radio and anything else I have, and I'm going to tell everybody forever, and you'll never be able to make me stop. And he kind of started laughing. Well, he did start laughing, and it was like, huh, you're either laughing because you're not bad, or you think I'm kidding. And I thought, well, we'll roll the dice and see where it goes. And after 15 years, he was laughing because he knew I just didn't know him very well.
Yeah. And there were a couple things he changed his mind on over the course of Congress, and you know, votes or things, he'd flip-flop, was what he would get accused of. And people would go, how did you do this as his staffer? Like, what changed? And every single thing that he changed his mind on or direction on while I was working for him was somebody gave him more information. There wasn't some lobbyist. There wasn't some donation from somebody. There wasn't, it was, he had a long conversation with usually me or somebody came in with the actual situation. And that was the thing. He wasn't fake. He didn't let anything get changed. He was always just trying to do what actually worked for our people. And that's really what would swing votes at the end of the day.
Like, have him change his mind.
Yeah. No amount of lobbying could have gotten him to swing.
Well, I mean, he was extremely pro-life. And mm-hmm. So I remember at the office, I think we all got calls from, the pro-choice groups who would say, well, I want to come and meet with him. And I'm like, hey, full disclosure, you could bring 500,000 people and camp out outside his farm, and he's not changing his mind.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a thing where he's going to tally votes and make a decision. He was deeply, deeply convicted on that and many other things.
I've been around where some of the pro-life groups would give him awards, and they'd be like, oh, you scored 100, here you go. And he would always say, you don't have to do that. Like, you got me anyway. You could spend those points on somebody else. he's like, you got me no matter what.
Yeah, he was never changing his mind on that. Yeah. You had, Brenda had something.
Oh, back when Sam was commenting about how Doug would counsel the hi kids or hey kids kind of thing, one of our sons was getting married, and they were kicking around ideas of who they would ask to do the ceremony for them. And I said, well, how about, it was Assemblyman at the time, Assemblyman Doug LaMalfa. They thought, oh, wow, would he really do that? And so I said, well, let's ask. So I did ask him, and he said he would be honored to. But he immediately was like, oh, my gosh, this is really important. And he wanted to counsel with them, so we set up an appointment. The kids were living in Sacramento at the time. He met them and sat down with them and counseled them on all the marriage kinds of things, from finances to togetherness and planning a family and Christian values and all the good stuff. He took that, I thought, just, do the ceremony, thank you.
yeah. Show up, take a bow.
I never realized how seriously he would take that, what an important calling that was for him. And I just was blown away by that. Just what a loving.
Did they pass? Did he marry him?
Yes, he did.
Oh, okay. I mean, because I could see him, like, feeling like they weren't ready. And
well, yeah. when I started kicking around the idea of proposing to my wife, he got wind of it, and he
the old lady.
Yeah, the old lady, my 5'2" old lady. And he called me into his office one day and closed the door, which meant that you were in trouble or something serious was happening, right? He never, pulled you into his office and closed the door. And he sat me down, and he asked a million questions about her and a million questions about my readiness. And then he was like, so you're going to take on all these responsibilities. And he listed off sort of all the responsibilities. He didn't know who my wife was. Never met her. But he asked questions that a father would ask to a guy who wanted to marry his daughter. You know, it was like, how are you going to take care of her? Do you have the plan? What are you going to do? When are you going to have kids? How's this? Is she a believer? Is she, are you the same, on the same team? And then sort of at the end of it, he was like, okay. And I was like, I didn't really ask for your okay. I think I'm in charge of that. But he really, he treated all of us like his kids. George can attest to that. He, especially the girls, when he couldn't walk them home, that would fall to us. DC's a scary place. He would walk Bella to work every morning.
Laura's daughter.
Laura's daughter, yeah. Sometimes to her protest, but he was really concerned about all of us, and I think that's why his death, especially in the DC office, hit really hard, because all of us are separated from our families.
Sure.
In DC, we're all sort of like islands out there, and he was like our dad, it's just real rough. to go through that. But yeah, no, I thought it was funny. He was like, are you sure that you're going to take care of this girl that I don't know?
Well, he was, you know, the way to really, you know, Doug, he didn't get mad that often. But if somebody was mean to us, like, I mean, you know, the usual, they call and tell us that we suck and some other words I can't use and stuff like that. And that's kind of garden variety. Like, he wasn't going to call all those people up. But if somebody was genuinely dismissive or mean to us as we were trying to do our job and it was uncalled for, all of a sudden, you know. Like
protective.
Super protective. I remember too, he was always really funny about it though. Like I was at a meeting about dam removal up in Siskiyou County, and I'm sitting in the Grange Hall and people there were really mad, and it was long before, you know, the state got involved and all that, but they had basically the pitchforks and the torches were out. They were signs, but they had, you know, pitchforks built onto them, and everybody was pretty worked up, and I'm texting Doug like the narration of what's happening and what this guy is saying and what people are doing, and this guy is just basically dismissing them and kicking them to the curb, which always made Doug really, you know, it made him really mad. He didn't want his constituents dismissed either. Super pissed about it, and he kept, you know, he was writing back and tell him this, and I was like, you know, raise my hand, and this guy's like, well, does your boss know what you're saying? And I'm like, yeah, it's on my phone right here. He's actually texting me that, and I texted him back. The guy wanted to know if, you know, if I had permission to say these things, and he writes back, spill as much blood as you can.
I remember that.
I showed it to the county supervisor sitting next to me, and he's like, oh, my God. He goes, you have the best job ever. Like, I know. I would do it for free. Oh, I can't tell you how many times I said that. I would do this for free. This is so much fun.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we were empowered to go defend people against the government.
Yeah. I mean, last fire season, I got a text in the middle of the day, and it was like, unleash the dogs or whatever. I know a guy who knows a guy in the Forest Service, and the Forest Service was telling telling him to call me off because Doug's attack dog was a bully. But, you know, nice. That was the thing. You would get, like, a big, spill as much blood. You get like the green light, and you would just get to go, and it would be to do something. It was never over something, you know, personal. It was like somebody in the district or something.
It was policy abuse.
Yeah, it was policy abuse. It was fires. Yeah. It was people getting screwed. And yeah, it was fun. I will say it was fun.
part.
I just think all the stories we heard yesterday really drove home the point that he genuinely cared about his constituents.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he worried about them all the time.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Worried about him. He'd always ask me, what does so-and-so think of this? How are those guys doing up there? You know, what's going to happen to them? That was always the thing.
Yeah.
When some train wreck was on its way, what's going to happen to them? What can we do? Do we have anything? Do we know anyone?
Yep.
Yeah. It was always the scramble to make sure people weren't crushed under the chariot wheels. Did hate those chariot wheels. Is that on the list? I don't know. Did we leave anything out? We have 2 whole minutes.
One initiation that new legislators had to do when going into Sacramento, they called it a weigh-in, and each person who wanted to participate would weigh in on day one of the legislature, and then they would see. The idea was you're going to gain a lot of weight because you're going to all these rubber chicken dinners. And there's all
it was literally a weigh-in. Okay.
It was a weigh-in on the scales. And Doug had put on some pounds. And so we were going to Bernie one night for an evening meeting. And he shows up in his red pickup, and he was gnawing on a carrot. And I think about this every time I'm cutting carrots or making salad or something. I think of this. He had this hunk of carrot, and he'd take a bite, put it on the dash. We'd go around corners, and that carrot was going back and forth on the dash.
I had a muffin that Chet made those travels in my car one time with him, yeah.
He'd get back over within reach. He'd grab it, take a chunk off, and put it back on the dash.
So he could pass the weigh-in.
Yeah. don't know how that ever worked
out. Something changed after that because he had a muffin. It was a chocolate muffin, and it looked really haggard. And, you know, I'm kind of inner retentive, so my car's always really clean. And he goes to get in the car, and he's taking all the stuff out of his Mustang, and he's putting it in my car, and then he comes with this muffin. And I'm thinking, no, this muffin's going to be everywhere. And it's like half eaten. I go, oh, maybe we could just leave that here. And he's like, well, no, I had it in D.C., and I had it at home, and I took it to D.C., and then I brought it back. The same muffin. It traveled 6,000 miles. I'm like, that is recycling at its peak.
Somebody yesterday was talking about how he would take oil filters back and forth.
Oh, yeah. Change. I remember the first time he did it. He goes, these filters out here are terrible. He goes, I'm going to take the oil filter back and change the oil in Pearl, the name of the the car. All right, we have to run away. George, Sam, Brenda, Laura, Aaron, Bill, which translates to Jungle George, Sam the Sham, Bun Bun, Landslide Laura, Air Bear, and Willis.
Yeah.
Until next time, this is WeThePeopleRadio.us.
Yesterday, when I was young, the taste of life was sweet, like rain upon my tongue. I teased at life as if it were a foolish game, the way an evening breeze would tease a candle flame. The thousand dreams I dreamed, the splendid things I planned, I always built to last on weak and shifting sand. I lived by night and shunned the naked light of day, and only now I see how the years have run away. Yesterday, when I was young, there were so many songs that waited to be sung, so many wild pleasures that lay in store for me, and so much pain my dazzled eyes refused to see.